Yeah, okay. Thanks, Juan. Hello, everyone. I'm Sijama, a graduate student at Caltech. Thanks, Juan, for inviting me to give this talk. In this talk, I will be introducing a new framework to do black hole spectroscopy. This framework is based on a new concept called quasi-normal mode filter, which can be classified into two subsets. The first one belongs to the rational filter, and the second one is called the full filter. So in the first part of this talk, I will be introducing the properties of the rational filter using some numerical relativity waveforms. Then in the second part of the talk, I will go through the, I will explain to you how to incorporate the rational filter into Bayesian inference. Then in the third part of the talk, I will briefly go through the idea of the full filter. And finally, as requested by Juan, I will go through the idea of the Cauchy characteristic matching. Let's start. To begin with, let's consider a binary black hole event. Its merger, its random stage corresponds to the oscillation of the remnant black hole. To the leading order, this process is governed by the Tarkovsky equation. An important concept of this topic is called quasi-normal mode, omega LMN, which is fully determined by the mass and spin of the remnant black hole. It is believed that the random waveform is a superposition of several quasi-normal modes. So if we can detect a quasi-normal mode from a random signal, we are able to determine the mass and spin of the remnant black hole. If multiple modes are detected at the same time, we can test the no-hear theorem. And this method is called black hole spectroscopy. So it is quite important to understand how many modes exist in the random region and when the random starts. By using numerical relativity waveforms, Gessler et al. Found that the random of GW15-0914 like numerical relativity waveform starts as early as the peak if enough overtone are included. Here I take this plot from their figure, and you can see after including seven overtones, the waveform starting from the peak is pretty consistent with the random prediction. And there have been lots of relevant studies after this work, but all of them are based on a quite similar method, namely fitting the random numerical waveform to a random template and see when the random when the fit improves. However, there is always an issue hunting around, namely the problem of overfitting. So, motivated by this problem, we came up with a new method to do black hole spectroscopy. This method is pretty straightforward. Here we define a frequency domain filter that is able to remove any particular quasi-normal mode from a random signal. In this way, we can first remove the most dominant mode, then the effect of the subdominant mode will be more pronounced. To be specific, let's here consider a toy model, namely the excitation of a single quasi-normal mode. Here, theta is the Heaviside step function, and the t naught is starting time. H of t is plotted as this black curve in the red panel. And you can see it is zero before t naught, and it is followed by a damped harmonic afterwards. A straightforward way to remove this mode content is to define a time domain operator, namely this d by dt plus I times the mode frequency. And it is very easy to check that after this operator, h of t just vanishes. But in practice, we know numerical differentiation leads to numerical noise. So we do this in the frequency domain, which corresponds to omega minus the mode frequency. But again, we see that this term is linear in omega. So it diverges at high frequency. So we further divide it by its complex conjugate. And this is the final form of our rational filter. After applying this filter to the original waveform, we obtain this red curve. You can see the original random quasi-normal mode is flipped to the other side. But if we restrict ourselves to the original random region, you can see the original random signal is removed completely. Then we can go to a more realistic system. Here I use a GW15-0914 like numerical relativity simulation. The black curve is the 2-2 harmonic. And it is also the one used by Gisler et al. To demonstrate the importance of the overtone. We first impose the filter of the first of the fundamental mode, and we obtain this red curve. And you can see that there are a few oscillations that are consistent with the first overtone, which is this blue dashed curve. So this result verifies that our filter can indeed remove the corresponding quasi-normal mode from the random region. Then we go ahead and remove more overtones and obtain this green curve. It's pretty interesting to see that there are a few oscillations that are consistent with the 3-2 mode, and those oscillations are still above the numerical error. So it implies that this is physical, and it is caused by the spherical-spherical harmonic mixing due to the spin of the remnant black hole. I hope this example can show you how our filter works. From this example, you can see we can first remove the most dominant modes from a random region, such as this fundamental mode. Then we can even visualize some subdominant modes, like this first overtone as well as the 3-2 mode. In this way, we don't have to worry about the issue of overfitting. Another example is to use our filter to look for second order quasi-normal modes in the random of BBH systems. Here at the leading order, we know that the black hole perturbation theory implies that a random signal can be written as a superposition of various quasi-normal modes. At the second order, there will be contributions due to the product of the linear effects. For example, let's first look at the 4-4 harmonic of the same numerical relativity event. It is expected that the 4-4 harmonic contains the contribution due to H22 squared. So in this panel, I first plot the black curve of the original 4-4 harmonic, and I impose the filters to remove the linear quasi-normal modes. And what I obtained is this red curve. You can see there are a few oscillations that are indeed consistent with the twice of the 220 mode, meaning that it is indeed the second order effect. Similarly, for the 5-5 mode, we expect there should be contributions from the due to 3-3 coupled to 2-2. And indeed, you can see after removing the 5-5 and the 6-5 linear quasi-normal modes, we do see the those oscillations are consistent with 2-2 plus the 3-3. Another example is for the retrograde mode. Here, let's look at other numerical relativity simulation. In this case, the binary black hole system has a mass ratio 4, and the two component spins are anti-aligned with the orbital angular momentum L, and their spin magnitudes are 0.8. The spin of the remnant black hole is almost zero. For this system, we expect to see the excitation of retrograde modes. So we first take its 2-2 harmonic, which is this black curve, and we remove the prograde modes. from this black curve and obtain this red curve. You can see in the filtered waveform, there are a few oscillations that are consistent with the 220 retrograde mode. To further verify this result, in the bottom panel, let me draw the phase evolution as a function of time. So for the prograde mode, we know that its time evolution is given by this t. This term e to minus I omega t. And let me remind you that the real part of the omega is positive. So its phase evolution decreases over time due to this minus sign. However, for the retrograde mode, it is given by e to I omega star t. And this time you can see we don't have the negative sign. So its phase evolution should increase over time. And indeed you can see this phase evolution curve starts to increase at the same time that those oscillations start to appear. So this result confirms that those oscillations do correspond to the retrograde mode. Our filter also enables us to find a mixing mode due to a gravitational recoil. Here, I don't have time to go through all the details. So on this page, I give you a few takeaway messages that are essential for my following discussions. The first goal is to, the whole point of this filter is to reveal the subdominant quaternary modes by removing the leading one. Second, this filter is imposed on the entire waveform, including spiral, merger, and ringdown, to avoid spectral leakage. So it is quite important to understand its impact on different parts of the waveform. First, its impact on the spiral part is just a trivial negative time and phase shift, meaning that the spiral part is shifted backwards in time. But you know, since we will be focusing on the ringdown region exclusively, this effect has no impact on our following discussions. In the second part, secondly, the filter flips the corresponding quaternary mode. Thirdly, the filter also reduces the amplitudes of other quaternary modes, and this reduction factor can be evaluated analytically. Finally, I want to emphasize that the corresponding quaternary mode can be removed regardless of its amplitude and phase, as well as inclination and polarization angles. This is an extremely important property I will go back to this point later. Here, let me go to the second part of this talk. Here, I will explain to you how to incorporate the rational filter into Bayesian inference. But before going to the details, I'd like to introduce two more properties of this rational filter used in the Bayesian inference. Yes.
There is a question. Maybe.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, sorry, I just had wanted to ask a question on the previous slide before you go on. So I was just also wondering what the impact would be if the frequency they use for your filter is slightly different from the actual quasi-norm mode frequency because of some error in extracting the final black hole remnant properties or things like that.
Yes, and that's a very good question. And indeed, we have a section discussed this. When mass and spin are different, what happens? So in the paper, we define the SNR of the ring down region. If you use the correct mass and spin to remove the those modes, the SNR will be reduced to a local minimum. But if you shift the mass and spin away from their true value, you cannot reduce the SNR of the ringdown to the minimum value. So I think this way we can know whether we are recovering the true mass and spin. Does that make sense?
Yeah, thanks. but there's sort of no danger of introducing like other spurious modes just by sort of incorrectly removing or only moving part of the fundamental mode?
Yeah, so if not enough modes are removed, there will be bias in recovering mass and spin.
Okay, yeah, thanks.
Yeah, okay. In the second part of this talk, I will explain to you how to incorporate the rational filter into Bayesian inference. You know, for the rational filter used it in the Bayesian inference, there are two additional properties. Firstly, we know that this filter depends on the frequency. So when we flip the sign of the frequency, the rational filter becomes complex conjugate, meaning that the filtered signal is still real. Second, we know that the modulus of the filter is unity, meaning that the filter can be written in this form, e to I delta Lmn. And this delta is a real number. As a result, the filter has no impact on power spectrum densities. To be more specific, let's go on this page. Let's look at the noise in the frequency domain given by n to the of I. To impose the filter on the noise, we simply multiply it by this phase factor. And then we insert the filtered noise into the expression below to compute the filtered power spectrum density. And you can see, you know, there is a combination of n times n star. And this phase factor just gets canceled out, meaning that the filtered PSD is the same as the original one. To verify this, we take the LIGO Hanford data of GW150914 with a length of 32 seconds. And we use the Welch method to estimate the PSD from either the raw data or the filtered data. And they are plotted as the black and the red curve. Basically, you can see they overlap with each other perfectly. And meanwhile, we also tried the conditioned data, and the conclusion is still the same. Then on this slide is the our major result. This rational filter enables us to construct a new likelihood function. And here we follow EC et al, and the likelihood is constructed in the time domain. To understand the logic, let's first recall how people built the traditional likelihood function for MCMC. Typically, one first builds a random template that consists of a set of quaternary modes. To do this, we need to insert their amplitudes and phases, and maybe even the polarization angles and the inclination angles. Then we subtract the template from the detected data, DI, and we insert the difference into the formula on the left to compute the likelihood to be pure noise. Here, T naught is the start time of the random window. It is treated as the hyperparameter in this Bayesian study. Capital T is the width of this random window. In our following discussions, I always fixed capital T to 0.2 second. So you can see that the traditional likelihood function depends on a bunch of parameters, you know, amplitudes, phases, mass and spin. But in our case, we need only the remnant mass and spin to construct the filter function. And after applying the filter, we expect there is no signal within the random region. So the corresponding likelihood function is given by the formula on the right. Therefore, in our case, you can see this new likelihood function is only two-dimensional. It depends only on the remnant mass and spin. The reason behind this is that the corresponding quaternary mode can be removed regardless of its amplitude and phase, as well as inclination and polarization angles. And it is very like we can get rid of a constant by taking a derivative, no matter what its value is. So, since our new likelihood function is merely two-dimensional, there is no need to use any fancy samplers, such as MCMC, to draw samplings. Instead, we can directly plot the likelihood as a function of mass and spin. Here, let me emphasize again, T naught is treated as a hyperparameter. So we fixed T naught in advance. Here, we take GW15.0914 as an example. I take GW15.0914 as an example, I plot how the likelihood function depends on mass and spin. Here, I use the same reference time as EC et al. This reference time is supposed to be the peak of the waveform. On this page, I set T naught to this reference time. In the left panel, I include only the fundamental mode, whereas in the right panel, I include both the fundamental mode and the first overtone. Here you can see this small white plus sign. It represents the IMR result. This white dashed contour comes from the traditional MCMC method without any filter. It encloses 90% credible region. We notice that our result is in perfect agreement with the traditional MCMC result, both in the left panel and in the right panel. And also we can see, starting from the reference time, after including the first overtone, we can have a better agreement with the IMR result. As we move on to a later time, such as 2.5 milliseconds after the reference time, you can see this time right now the fundamental mode becomes better and it agrees with the IMR result. So this is an indirect evidence to support the existence of the overtone. Here, let me summarize quickly the performance of this new likelihood function. First, it is extremely fast and efficient to evaluate this function. It takes only milliseconds on my personal laptop. If you want to generate a low resolution 2D plot, it only takes 8 seconds on my personal laptop. This low resolution plot is already good enough to show to reveal the features of GW15.0914. If you want to further make a production run with an incredibly high resolution, it only takes 3 minutes on a 24-core cluster. And all those calculations are not fully parallelized. Second, our algorithm is fully parallelizable because the evaluation of each pair of mass and spin is fully independent. Thirdly, our code doesn't slow down after increasing the number of modes because multiple filters can be imposed simultaneously. This is quite different from the traditional MCMC method because its speed depends sensitively on the dimension of the MCMC. Finally, I have shown that the posteriors obtained from our approach are consistent with the traditional MCMC analysis. Here, let me discuss the impact of the start time of the ring down window, namely this T naught. Yes.
Can I ask a question about
yes
sort of the filter that you're imposing, right? In some sense, it is fitting for the amplitude and phase, right? And finding a maximum likelihood amplitude and phase, and then it's going to subtract that from the data. I mean, that's what. So it's removing, right, any amplitude phase that would be corresponding to the frequency, right? That's your claim.
Yes, but we are not fitting the amplitude and the phase, because it's like you can get rid of a constant by taking derivative. In this process, you don't have to know what its value is, right? So in this case, we simply need to know the mass and the spin, and that's it. The corresponding mode can be removed immediately,
right,
no matter what its amplitude and the phase is.
Right, right. So what I'm claiming is that the procedure, the filter that you've set out, effectively does that maximization process for you and subtracts out the best fit.
Yes, yes? And that's a good question. So, you know, effectively speaking, our method marginalizes mass and spin. Amplitude and the phase. Then reduced to this simple 2D likelihood function. And we are still thinking about what's the mathematical connection between our new likelihood function and the traditional one. There must be a way to marginalize the traditional MCMC, traditional likelihood function.
Right, right. So my question was that I think that your filter is maximizing over the amplitude and phase. So if you take the traditional likelihood and you maximize that, which is a derivative and can be real messy, and maybe your filter does that efficiently, right? But the maximized likelihood would then just be two-dimensional. But you are not going to appropriately account for the fact that you don't actually know the amplitude and phase necessarily, right? So in some sense, the reduced likelihood that you've proposed is not going to account for the full uncertainty in the model, because you are maximizing instead of marginalizing over certain parameters that you may not know.
Yes, that's a good question. At this moment, I still don't fully understand how two likelihood functions connect. Yeah, that's the thing that I want to explore in the future. But you know, from our current results, you see, after using the traditional MCMC method and marginalizing over the phase and the amplitude, they give the same result as our new method. So at least from this sense, our method is more efficient and more. It's faster to recover the distribution of mass and spin without doing MCMC. And the other thing I want to emphasize, which is, you know, just on this slide, is to, you know, we can use this method to determine when the random starts. Because it is fast, we can compute, you know, the distribution for a bunch of starting time. Yeah, maybe I can explain to you. I can go through this page first.
Thanks. We can talk more later.
Okay.
Can I ask a question on the same lines?
Yes.
So when you're comparing to MCMC, you're treating the amplitudes as extra MCMC parameters, right? But I mean, for a fixed mass and spin, because it's because the waveform is linear in the amplitudes, we already know that it's going to be Gaussian. The probability distribution is going to be Gaussian in the amplitudes, and so, you know, I mean, there should be a similar way to reduce the dimensions in the traditional MCMC analysis, and I don't know. I was just wondering if you've thought about, well, is it are these two different methods going to be equivalent? And that's if you were able to, for example, just reduce the dimensions in the MCMC by, you know, saying that the amplitudes are Gaussian, the probability distribution is Gaussian in the amplitude. And so, would this be?
Yeah.
Would it be equivalent, or are you doing something different?
Yeah. In fact, I'm thinking about this question in the past 2 weeks, but I still don't have any answer yet, because, you know, in this treatment, we impose the filter in the frequency domain and transfer the filtered waveform to the time domain and make a cut, Mm-hmm. And this whole procedure makes the study very complicated. How to make a theoretical connection to the original one. In the original one, it's just a linear. Everything are linear, so we can easily do the marginalization. But in this case, it's a little bit difficult. This is the thing that I'm still thinking about.
Okay. Thank you.
Yes. Okay. Let me continue. So, given t naught, we can compute the likelihood function as a function of mass and spin. Then we can further integrate it over this 2D space. And this gives us the mode evidence for this particular filter. And it is a function of t naught, which is the start time of the random window. And in this plot, I use the GW Phaeton 0914 and plot how the model evidence depends on this T naught. It's pretty interesting to see that, remind you that the blue curve includes only the fundamental mode, whereas the red curve includes both the fundamental and the first overhaul. And you can see both curves surge very quickly near the onset of the random. And this feature automatically tells us when the random starts. Let me emphasize again that to make this type of plot, we simply need to impose a filter on the raw data without any further information. So in principle, we can do this treatment to any detected data. And so it is interesting to see whether we can use this feature to dig out any potential GW event from noise. Furthermore, here on this page, we can use the model evidence to compute the Bayes factor for the first overhaul in the random of GW Phaeton 0914. It is defined to be the ratio between two model evidence. You can see this Bayes factor decreases over time and near the onset of the random very sharply. And afterwards, it just jumps up and down around a very small value, which is below 10. And around this reference time, and the Bayes factor for the first overtone is as high as 600. So this is other evidence to support the existence of the first overtone in the range of GW Phaeton 0914. In fact, there is a third way to use this filter to do black hole spectroscopy. For the moment,
can I ask?
Yes.
Yes. You mentioned that if you apply the filter to multiple mode, it will suppress other mode, right? Is it so? Now you have a large. So let's see. You have some residual signal, but if you just apply more and more filters, maybe the filter frequency is not so correct, but still you suppress other modes. So would that give you a reduced Rindon signal residuals or a better Bayes factor in this case?
I have tried that if you include an additional irrelevant mode, there will be a very tiny impact on this evidence curve. For example, after I include the second overtone, the model evidence is just almost identical to this red curve. So meaning that there is no effect from the second overtone. But indeed, that's a good question. From this plot, at least for this event, we can confirm that we are able to recover the correct mass and spin. But maybe in the future, we should go into more details to see what kind of bias we might get if we impose more filters. That's the thing I want to explore in the future. For this event, we know there are only two modes, so this one is easier to investigate.
Okay.
So And there is the third approach to do black hole spectroscopy. So far, my discussion is quite independent of the traditional MCMC method, but we can combine them together. Here, I list the idea of this mixed approach. We can first remove a subset of quasi-normals using the filter. Then we can fit the filtered data to the remaining quasi-normal mode model using the traditional MCMC approach. There are two advantages of this method. First, we can obtain information of the remaining modes without the impact of the other modes. For example, for GW15-09-14, there have been lots of debates whether we have detected the first overtone. I think the major reason is that the search for the first overtone is always impacted by the existence of the fundamental mode. So if we can first remove the fundamental mode, then the first overtone will be the most dominant mode in the ring down of the filtered data. Then we can repeat the standard MCMC method and see whether we can find the evidence of the first overtone. I think this will give us more direct evidence for the subdominant modes. Second, yes.
I think there is many people are concerned, not just because the fundamental mode may affect the sensitivity on the subdominant mode. It's also that in order to find this overtone mode, you need to start the fitting early, right? Like you need to start at T equals 0 or 5 or something like that. People worry about other things may contaminate the signal, or it's not contamination, but it's like such as nonlinear effects. So it's not, right? Like it's not the linear summation mode, but there is other things playing in this very early time. So if you try to use this linear mode to fit, then you have some theoretical bias or something like that. So
yeah. So that's the reason that I write down this cross check. After removing all those stuff, and we can repeat the whole thing, and we can compare the new results with the original one and see if we can get consistent results. If not, it may imply that there are some other things. But for GW15-09-14, I will show you in the next slide. They are fully consistent. Before that, let me just mention the last point. The second advantage of this mixed approach is that we can we can remove all but one of the quasi-normal modes. Then we use the MCMC to fit the remaining mode. In this way, we can infer mass and spin from every single quasi-normal mode. And this can put the testing no-hair theorem in a richer context. As I just mentioned, I still take GW15-09-14 as an example. I first repeat the standard MCMC method using the data without any filter. And it gives me the blue shaded region in both panels. Here, the left panel corresponds to the posterior of the amplitude of the fundamental mode. And the right one is the amplitude of the first overtone. And then I can first impose the filter of the fundamental mode, namely F220, and then use MCMC to fit the filtered data with two QM template. Here the template includes both the fundamental mode and the first overtone, by assuming that the fundamental mode is still in the data. And what I obtained is this green dashed curve. You can see after imposing the filter, the amplitude of the fundamental mode is pushed to the left, and now it is consistent with zero. But for the amplitude of the first overtone, it is almost seen as the original blue shaded distribution, right? And So this indicates that our filter can indeed remove the fundamental mode from the ring gun of the end of GW180914. And given this observation, we can further fit the filtered data with one QNM model. Here, this QNM is just corresponds to the first overlap. And what I obtained is this yellow shaded region. Again, you can see it is pretty close to the other two distributions. Similarly, we can also impose the filter of the first overlap, namely F221, and then we fit the filtered data with two QNM template, and this leads to the black dashed curves. In particular, in the left panel, we can see after imposing the filter, now the amplitude of the first overtone is pushed to the left, meaning that it is the first overtone is removed. I think this is other evidence to support the existence of the first overtone in the sense of the mode the amplitude distribution. So then on this slide, we can further infer the mass and spin from each single quasi-normal mode. Here to obtain the right contours, we can first impose the filter of the first overtone and then fit the filtered data with the fundamental mode, meaning that the right contours are the mass and spin inferred from the fundamental mode itself. Similarly, we can also infer the mass and spin from the first overtone itself. This gives us the yellow shade, yellow contours. It's pretty interesting to see that the first overtone itself is still informative, and it is consistent with the fundamental mode as well as the full analysis without filter. So I think this is other evidence for the first overtone. Okay, so. In the third part of this talk, I will briefly go through the idea of the full filter. And let me remind you again that the full filter belongs to the second class of the QNM filter. So the construction of this full filter is based on the black hole perturbation theory. Let's consider the upmost solution to the homogeneous Tolkowski equation. This solution is plotted on this Penrose diagram. Its physical meaning is pretty clear. There is an outgoing component emerging from the past horizon, and this wave gets reflected by the black hole potential and falls into the future horizon, whereas the rest of the wave escapes to infinity. And the coefficient at the past horizon is given by D out. And let's further remember the definition of a quasi-normal mode. A quasi-normal mode is defined to be a purely outgoing component at scry, at future infinity, as well as a purely ingoing component at horizon, meaning that the mode frequency is defined to be the zeros of D out. As a result, we can expand D out in terms of this expression omega minus the mode frequency, and you can already see that this term is identical to the numerator of the rational filter. So in principle, this D out should place the same role as the rational filter to remove any to remove the corresponding quasi-normal modes. But in practice, we know that D out diverges at low frequency, at zero. So we further divide it by its complex conjugate. And this is the final form of our full filter. Unlike the rational filter, which was constructed purely empirically, in this case, the full filter has a physical meaning. To go through the physical meaning, I need to introduce the one waveform model first. This one is called the hybrid method, which was proposed by Nichols and Chen around one decade ago. This is an approximate waveform model in parallel with EOB and the numerical relativity. The idea of this waveform model is to split the space-time of a binary black hole system into an inner host Newtonian region and an outer black hole perturbation region. As the name suggests, the interior metric comes from the PN theory, and the exterior metric comes from the black hole perturbation theory. And they communicate through the boundary conditions on this time-like shell. By evolving two systems together, we are able to construct metric data in the bulk, as well as the wavelet screen. Here our goal is not to construct a waveform model. Instead, our goal is to use this waveform model to help us understand the physical meaning of the full filter. We know that we have obtained waveforms at future null infinity from your Markov relativity. So we can inverse the whole procedure. We can evolve the waveform from scrum into the bulk. During this process, we ignore the existence of the of this time-like shell. We simply solve the Tolkowski equation and treat the waveform at scrum as the boundary condition. As a result, the solution is proportional to this up mode, and the coefficient is given by the waveform at scrum. And you can see that there is an outgoing component at the past horizon given by H multiplied by D out. And let me remind you again that this D out is proportional to our full filter. So the filtered waveform is proportional to this outgoing component emerging from the past horizon. And we know that this past horizon doesn't belong to the outer PN region. So this outgoing component is not real, but we can still think of this component as an image wave, which exists here to provide boundary conditions on this time-like shell and to drive the outer perturbation region. This idea is pretty similar to the idea of the image charge. You know, from the electrodynamics, we know that we have a spherical conductor and an electric charge. The E field outside this region is equivalent to putting an image charge over here. Similarly, in our case, the filtered waveform corresponds to the image wave on the past horizon to drive the outer perturbation region. You can also think of it as a source. Very interestingly, we know the linear quasi-normal modes at scry doesn't need source because it is a solution to the homogeneous Tolkowski equation, meaning that there is no image wave at the past horizon. This is equivalent to seeing that the quasi-normal modes are removed by the full filter. A consequence of this inverse hybrid method is that we can use a waveform at future null infinity from your Markov relativity to construct a metric around a binary black hole system in the bulk. In our previous work, we used this method to construct a gravitational wave echo model. But you know, since we are able to do this metric reconstruction, maybe we can also explore the second order perturbation theory. But this is the thing that I want to explore in the future. Finally, I just want to mention that there is a direct analog of this hybrid method in numerical relativity. It is called Cauchy characteristic matching. We know that for the inner evolution, we have this PN treatment, and for the outer region, we have this perturbation treatment. But here we can promote the inner PN treatment to the standard Cauchy evolution adopted by numerical relativity community. And for the outer perturbation region, we can promote it to the characteristic evolution. Then by allowing two systems communicating on this time-like shell, we are able to evolve two systems together and solve the Einstein's equations. It has been an open question whether a stable full 3D CCM exists. Recently, we are able to solve this problem by building a fully realistic 3D CCM algorithm in a numerical relativity code called Spectre. You know, so as requested by Huan, I will briefly go through our progress about CCM. To begin with, let's first recall how people prefer numerical relativity simulation. A standard way is to adopt 3+1 decomposition, and the Einstein's equations are converted to a Cauchy problem by providing inertial data on the first slice as well as boundary conditions. Then we can evolve the system forward in time, slice by slice. Here we need to truncate the spacetime at a finite radius because our computational domain is always finite, unless you use hyperboloidal slicing, but that's a different story. Unfortunately, the most interesting part we care about is the gravitational wave at scry. It is where our detector is. So a question is, how do we deal with the region in the middle, you know, from the outer boundary of the Cauchy system to scry? For the outer wave zone, we can try a different formalism to solve the Einstein's equations. In particular, we can change the way that we slice the spacetime. For the inner Cauchy evolution, you see we adopt space-like hypersurfaces. But for the outer wave zone, we can try null slices to adapt to the propagation of gravitational waves. This method is called characteristic evolution. So you can see by combining the Cauchy part and the characteristic part, we are able to build an algorithm to extract gravitational waves unambiguously from a numerical relativity simulation. And this procedure is called Cauchy characteristic extraction, or CCE. However, there is a caveat rooted in this procedure. We need to finish the inner Cauchy evolution first. Then we construct metric data on the outer boundary. Then we treat the we can call it a word tube. Then we can use the word tube data as boundary condition to evolve the outer characteristic evolution. Here, in order to perform an accurate Cauchy evolution, an important step is to prescribe accurate outer boundary conditions. This is not an easy task because, you know, due to the nonlinearity of Einstein's equations, an outgoing gravitational wave intrinsically backscatters of the spacetime curvature from the region outside the outer boundary. And the backscattered wave can re-enter the Cauchy computational domain again. So an accurate boundary condition needs to take this effect into account. This is an impossible task unless you use the characteristic system to deal with the outer wave zone. In spec, when we were producing all those production runs, we simply ignored this contribution. But a compromise is that we need to put the outer boundary far away from the system. Lots of computational resources. So to work around this problem, we can design a new system called Cauchy characteristic matching. In this method, we let the inner Cauchy system provide boundary conditions for the outer characteristic system. Meanwhile, we let the characteristic system to feedback the information of the backscattered wave into the inner Cauchy evolution. Then this backscattered wave is used as boundary conditions of the Cauchy evolution. Then we can evolve the Cauchy data to the next time slice. After that, we simply repeat the whole process, and then we can solve the Einstein's equations. Our numerical implementation is based on a numerical relativity code called Spectre, developed by Caltech and Cornell. Here, the inner Cauchy evolution adopts the generalized harmonic formulation. where the Einstein's equations are written as a first order hyperbolic partial derivative equation. At the outer boundary, the Birkhoff's method is used to impose the boundary conditions on the first time derivative of the incoming characteristic field. Roughly speaking, the boundary conditions can be classified into three subsets, including the constraint part, the Dirich part, and the physical part. And it is the physical part that needs to contain the information of the backscattered wave. So we use the characteristic system to predict and to compute this information and fit that back into the Birkhoff's boundary conditions. So far, we have used our code to run a few 3D systems fully relativistically. Pretty surprisingly, those runs are stable. And we have had very strong evidence to show that superior numerical reflections at the outer boundaries are reduced due to the new matching term. Second, the interface between the Cauchy and the characteristic system is transparent to physical gravitational waves, meaning that you can send gravitational waves either from the Cauchy to characteristic system or from the characteristic to the Cauchy system. But here I don't have time to go into the details of my tests. We are still working on the paper. Hopefully they will come out soon, later this year. Okay, so a quick summary. Sorry about talking about so many things. So in the second part, I go through the idea of the rational filter and how they can be used in Bayesian framework. The second part, I go through the idea of the full filter and mention its connection to the metric reconstruction and how we can use that to compute echoes. Thirdly, I just briefly mentioned the idea of the Cauchy characteristic matching project. For the future work, I hope our method can be a powerful tool to do black hole spectroscopy in the near future. I'm working with LIGO people to see whether we can make our method a pipeline to study O4 observations. I think that's pretty much it. Thanks for listening, and I'm happy to take other questions. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? Maybe I can start. So this CCM, so you mentioned that you have to impose data on this characteristic surface. How do you determine what kind of data you want? Like physically, you're saying this is an ingoing gravitational wave, but how do you determine like how much incoming gravitational wave?
Yes. So simply, from black hole perturbation theory, we know that psi zero is characterized the incoming wave, whereas the psi four represents the outgoing wave. So from the characteristic system, we are able to compute psi zero on the matching surface. And then we use psi zero to compute the backscatter wave and insert this wave into the Birkhoff's boundary condition.
So this psi zero is computed assuming a post-Newtonian source?
No. It's fully realistic. It's in fully Einstein's theory, without any approximation.
I mean, it's a function of the source inside, right? Like, as there is.
For the outer characteristic system, we are able to construct psi zero in the boundary frame up to a BMS freedom. So we can either at square or at this work cube. So we can insert this psi zero into the inner Cauchy system. But there will be very complicated tetrad transformation to transfer the tetrad from the boundary coordinates and coordinates to the inner Cauchy systems. This is a very difficult mathematical problem.
Right, right. I understand. So what I'm trying to ask is this related to the source inside? Like, do you need to know the source inside to determine what size there is before you impose this data?
Kind of. So you see here the source inside determines the metric on this word cube. And this word cube is treated as boundary conditions for us to evolve the characteristic evolution. So yes, the word cube data contains the information of the source. So so you can see we have two systems, Cauchy and characteristic system, and they communicate at the boundary through the boundary conditions. And the boundary conditions contain the information from both sides.
So I have a question. So I imagine when you're doing the CCM, you have to construct initial data on your initial characteristics of sigma one, right?
Yes.
And if there's junk radiation there, it's going to keep going in inside forever.
So there's
physical effects forever, right? And
yes. So one thing is that I'm looking at very simple systems, you know, a single black hole or a Tarkovsky wave. So for those systems, the initial data of the characteristic system is unimportant. And on the other hand, you know, besides the inverse cubic initial data, there is another one called conformal factor, which is able to give us more accurate CCE and the CCM simulations. And I think that one is used by Keith et al. To construct a CCE surrogate model. And I think that one gives us more accurate initial data, initial condition for characteristic system.
Yeah, but if I recall what they do, because they have the full Cauchy evolution inside, they use that to extrapolate outside, but in CCM, you won't have that.
So, yeah, that's the thing that I need to explore in the future. But for the moment, I haven't touched on the initial data of this problem.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But that's a good question.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
So do you anticipate that the characteristic evolution would add any appreciable time to the binary black hole simulation, or that would be sort of subdominant to doing the Cauchy evolution part?
You mean the impact of CCM on BBH simulation? For the moment, I would think that's a subdominant effect, an improvement. But I think one thing we can benefit from the CCM, which I can think of at this moment, is to put the outer boundary of the Cauchy system much inside, so we can improve the efficiency, the computational efficiency, and speed up the full calculation. I don't know. At least at this point, I don't know what else we can benefit from. CCM. Yeah, but that's the thing that we need to think about, you know, the sense case of CCM.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, if no more questions, let's thank Susan again.
Thanks.